Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, friends, and happy Friday, or Fri-yay, as my kids say, as the end of the school week is approaching. Maybe the end of the work week is approaching for you. As a nurse, I kind of don't get those weekend kind of rhythms, but I hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, that you're having a great day. Now, we are progressing. We're almost halfway through January. Can you even believe that? And is my Christmas tree still up? Why, yes. Yes, it is. Has it been up since October? Why? Yes. Yes, it has. And are the lights now actually burning out on my tree? Well, yes, they are. And am I sorry about that? Not even a little bit. But hey, babe, sorry, y'all, my husband is listening somewhere. I want you to picture a brilliant rocket scientist who is completing complex thermonuclear equations. Okay, I did just make that term up, but he can't figure out how to talk his wife into taking down the tree. So, okay, honey, if you're listening, and I know you are, the tree can come down tomorrow. Okay, all right. Yes, all four of the trees that are still left up. What can I say? I love Christmas, and it's really hard to let it go. But if you have been following along with us in the new year, I hope that you have said yes to jump into my challenge to adopt 52 habits for healthy parenting this year. Now, I'm really excited because I actually ordered in the mail this week a little map that I'm going to keep track of all of the people from all over the country who are joining in on this. And so far, we have about 8 states represented. So if you are saying, hey, that's me, I'm in, I want to try to adopt 52 habits for healthy parenting, I want to invest in my parenting journey in 2024, then just you can find me on social media, or you can send me an email through my website, that's drnursemama.com, and just let me know where you're listening from, and we will add you to our map. We would love to have somebody from all 50 states. Now, the 2 habits that we've talked about so far, these are foundational building blocks of parenting. I've been saying, I know some of you are saying, when are you going to get to the good stuff? Well, this is the best stuff right here. The 2 habits that we have adopted so far in January are, number 1, incorporating prayer more into your daily life, however that looks for you. And number 2 is memorizing scriptures. So the scriptures that I have memorized so far from Proverbs 16, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and he will establish your plans. And I'm working this week on Isaiah 12:2. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. It's on a post-it note on my bathroom mirror, on my dashboard. It's my lock screen on my phone. I encourage you to do that because, again, God's word is so much wiser than any words that we have as parents. So I hope that you will join in on the journey, and next week we will introduce habit number 3. But today is Friday, and that is the day I answer all the questions. We call this Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday, and boy, do y'all have some good questions for me this week. So buckle in, and I'll walk through them. Now, one of the most common questions that I get just generally since COVID is, how did COVID impact pediatric development? Now, I was president of my national organization all during COVID. Oh, that was really fun and unexpected and a challenging journey for sure. But this is something that I follow very closely as a professor, as a leader, as a nurse practitioner practicing in pediatrics, and as a mom. I have kids myself. I was really concerned about the impact COVID would have. And I firmly believe that COVID was a very significant social, emotional, and developmental injury for our children. Teens especially were impacted, and young babies were impacted. Now, I can tell you, you know, as a practicing nurse, one of the things that broke my heart the most during COVID was seeing all these mamas who had babies, and the visitor policy did not allow any visitors. And so they may have had babies alone or with only one person there with them, and trying to choose is so difficult for so many families in so many different situations. And so I really could go on and on about this, and I am paying very close attention to this in my professor life. But the question that I'm getting mostly is, did mask wearing impact kids' development and just the social isolation that they had? So there was a big study, a very big study that just was released last week that I want to share with you. And it told us, honestly, what we already know. Infants and toddlers absolutely faced social, emotional, developmental delays during the COVID-19 pandemic. And this study in particular was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or we call it JAMA Pediatrics. And I am most happy with this study because it was led by a nurse researcher out of the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And really, the idea for this study stemmed from her work as a nurse home visitor for something called the National Visiting Nurse Service Nurse Family Partnership. So these are nurses who go out to individual homes and they provide care in the homes, which is actually really how the modern nursing role started. And she shared that she felt like she was making more referrals to early childhood intervention during the pandemic than before. That is known to anyone practicing in pediatrics. But knowing something intuitively is a lot different than knowing something through research and being able to measure and see in black and white and look at proof of this and be able to say, this is exactly what happened. So when your kids go to your pediatric primary care provider, we use a questionnaire called the Ages and Stages questionnaire. You might hear your provider refer it to it as the ASQ. And it basically measures development. And we have different age groups that we do that at. So there are some for 12 to 18 months and some for, you know, younger ages that we're measuring specific developmental milestones to make sure that your baby's on track. Now, this study looked at that ASQ and looked at the actual score that changed. And the study included 60,171 families who were enrolled in that national visiting program that I told you about between 2015 and 2021. So what the researchers did was they divided the families into four groups of pandemic exposure that was based on the child's age. So they looked at kids who were 2 at the start of the pandemic, kids who were 1 when it started, kids who were infants, and children who were born after the pandemic began. And when they looked at the results of this, they saw significant differences on those ASQ. And so we're looking at things like problem solving and fine motor skills. Now, there were some differences in those age groups, but basically what it found was that referrals to early intervention increased, and some referrals actually decreased, but that could be because they didn't have access to services, looking at those different age groups. And we just saw what we already know, that the pandemic impacted development through a lot of different ways. And so there's a lot of parents who are out there. And if you're a parent of a young child, I know that this has crossed your mind thinking, you know, is my child on track? What happened? What can we do? Here's where I can give you a really strong word of encouragement. We don't have a lot of research about the impacts of COVID, but we do have a lot of research about the science of premature babies. So those are babies who are often behind on their developmental milestones. And we know from that research that it takes babies up to 2 years to catch up. We actually, when we chart them in the office, we are adjusting their age to when they were supposed to be born for 2 years. We're doing that. And we know that most of them catch up really beautifully. And I think that we can take some encouragement from that. We also know that babies and kids are extremely resilient. And if they have meaningful connection to an adult in their life, they are going to catch up in most cases. So one of the things that you can do, let me give you some tips on just how, what babies need, what kind of sensory stimulation they need. They need tactile stimulation, that is touch. They need auditory stimulation, that's hearing, of course, visual stimulation, that's obviously seeing, and kinetic stimulation, that is moving. Now, the order includes, it usually goes from they feel tactile stimulation first, then vestibular, which is movement, and chemical auditory visual. So I'm giving you a little tiny lesson in baby development here, but the baby has five senses working at very different levels already from the time of birth. And babies feel that tactile and vestibular system sensations because they feel it when their mom walks, when she laughs, when she talks, when she exercises. All of those different feelings have different feelings for babies. Now, if you have held a baby and you just have this instinct to pat its little bottom and just pat, or you jiggle a little bit, or you just have that little movement. When you pat a baby on the bottom, that really stimulates what it felt like for them when they were in their mother's womb, when the mother is walking. It's that same kind of rhythmic sensation. That's why when moms are expecting babies, they often sleep during the day because moms are up walking. But when moms lay down at nighttime, they have a lot of room to play. And so that's a lot of times why that sleep-wake cycle is different, in case you were wondering. And the auditory cues, this is fascinating to me. They include heartbeat. They can hear the mom's heartbeat, whether it's slow or whether it's fast, and they have those auditory cues. So ways that you can help your baby, if you're wondering, how can I help my baby with development, you can introduce a different variety of textured objects. That's great tactile stimulation. So blankets that feel different. Some might be a little more scratchy, some might be a little more soft, or that's why, all of the toy companies sell all of these different toys that have different textures and different feels. That's great. That is stimulating your baby's brain to work. You can also have face-to-face time with babies. Babies really need to see that face-to-face connection. They need eye contact. And I know most of us have been in public somewhere where a baby catches your eye and, oh, don't they just capture your heart? They love having that visual eye contact, which is really good for their brains. And, spending time thinking about the different noise levels in your house is really good too. There may be times where it's noisier. There may be times when it's quieter. And so just think about, what are those different kind of auditory cues that you are providing? You can play music that's appropriate. Classical music is actually very well documented in research to stimulate brain development. Looking at books is one of the best ways to stimulate baby development in their brain. So looking at different books with different colors and different textures, and especially those cardboard books where babies can mouth them, can teeth on those are really, really good too. So just really thinking about those different kinds of ways that you can interact with and engage with your baby. And now, babies don't often understand the meaning of words, but they really understand the implication of facial expressions. So smiling at your baby, talking, laughing really helps. And by the way, if you have a baby who's struggling with separation anxiety, I know that can be really taxing on moms, but you can take assurance knowing it just means their brain is working well. They're developing a concept called object permanence when they realize you exist, even when they can't see you. So little games like peekaboo are really helpful in training the brain to know, okay, mommy may have disappeared, or I can't see daddy or sissy, but they'll be back. And that is what we're going to do. We're going to be back in just a minute. I have a lot more to talk to you about today. We're going to talk about sleepovers. I'll give you my thoughts on Dry January and a new movie that I'm hearing talked about in teens that I'm extremely concerned about. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back to Happy Friday. And it is Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday, where I answer all the questions that I can that have been coming in this week. And I have been answering questions about impacts of COVID on the pandemic. Now, this week, I got a question from a mom asking about sending her daughter on a sleepover. And this is actually a question that I get very commonly and that I've talked about before. So here's the question. Should you let your kids have sleepovers? Now, there's, as you probably have figured out with most of these things, there often isn't a very concrete answer. And for me, I try very hard as a mom to be very careful and judicious about things that are absolutely no. And I try to make that list as short as possible. For me, sleepovers are going to be generally no, although I'm willing to entertain proposals as an exception. Now, sleepovers, again, you have to think about this, you know, as in when kids are going to sleep, what good is going on after that? What good is it, especially for teenagers? You think about, they go to sleep, they're usually not going to go to sleep till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You're going to have to wake them up the next morning. They're not going to have brushed their teeth or eaten breakfast, and they're going to roll out to your car and their PJs with bedhead, and nothing really is going to have happened after they went to sleep. And my concern is that the risk for risk-taking behaviors goes up significantly after midnight. Now, that's not scientific. That's just my mom voice speaking to you. And my kids can tell you that I have shared that with them many, many times, is that nothing good happens at a sleepover after midnight. And I have seen this play out in my clinical practice and in my own home, to be honest. I've shared before in my book, even Behind Closed Doors, A Guide for Parents and Teens to Navigate Through Life's Toughest Issues, a story where my daughter had a sleepover about the same age, and another girl asked me for a Sharpie. And I said, "What are you going to do with that Sharpie?" And she said, "I'm going to draw a mustache on your daughter's face." And I said, "No, that's not going to happen." Well, it did end up happening anyway, because good kids make poor choices. And sometimes that can happen. But I've also had instances, especially in this day and age, where phones are involved and you have different rules for different households. That can be a real challenge. And so what I see is there are kids who are FaceTiming or talking with other kids at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is just never a good idea. You do not have your best judgment as a kid, even in the middle of the day, oftentimes with supervision. And 3 a.m., especially if you're in your bedroom, that's just going to lower your inhibitions and make you feel safer and, you know, more willing to be vulnerable and transparent than you would in other circumstances. So that can be really hard. And then you have kids at a sleepover with, some of them have social media, some of them don't have social media. You have different rules for different houses. And so what I would say is that most parents, you know whether you feel good about a sleepover situation or you don't. You know whether you know the family and have a very high degree of trust or you don't. what parents usually find as the barrier is coming against their child and saying no. And the child begs and they plead and they tell you, you're the worst parent. You're the meanest parent. Nobody else's parent has these problems. These are parenting problems as old as time. And so the encouragement that I would offer to parents is, don't be afraid to be the parent. Don't be afraid to say no and to put your foot down and just to say, you know, I don't feel good about this. I am in charge of your safety. That is my responsibility. I realize that you don't understand and that you don't agree, and I'm okay with that. Now, again, this is just coming from Jessica, the mama, but a lot of times what I'll tell my kids, if they are wanting, especially at that younger age where they're wanting to argue, I'll say, you can argue with me, but I'm older than you. I'm wiser than you. I have more money than you. I have more resources than you. I have more backup than you do. And frankly, I have more skin in this game. I'm more invested at this point in your safety than you are. And so if you're going to be upset with me, I love you enough to do that. My kids will still laugh at me and tell me that, but don't be afraid to be the parent, because there are some things that can happen in a sleepover situation that are potentially devastating. I'm talking about worst case scenarios like issues of abuse or accidentally encountering a firearm or things like that that I have seen in my practice. So don't be afraid to follow your parental intuition and just say no. Now, as a compromise, often what I would do with my kids is I would say, you can go to the sleepover, but I'll pick you up at 10 o'clock. And they just started to get comfortable with that and to know that that was the boundary, that was the compromise, and they were going to take it. And I can share with you now that my kids are a little older, there were many times when my kids would tell me, guess what happened after I left? And they learned to start to be grateful for that protection, that they weren't there when those things happened, when those things went down, when people decided to sneak out or whatever it is that happened. So my answer for sleepovers is, it depends. Usually I would say no, trust your instincts, and don't be afraid to be the parent. Another question I've been getting this week is, what is dry January? It's actually been around for a little while, but it's funny how much it seems to have taken off on social media. Now, Dry January actually started as a campaign in 2013, so more than a decade ago, and it was started by Alcohol Change UK to encourage adults to stop drinking alcohol for 31 days in the new year, to improve their physical and their mental health, saying, hey, you want to stop? Just try to stop for January. Now, for this first year in the United Kingdom, there were 4,300 adults who said yes to Dry January. Now, a study was done of Dry January by the University of Sussex in England, because this trend actually did start in the United Kingdom in 2018, and they found the following health benefits of those who participated. 71% reported improved sleep. 58% reported weight loss just from stopping drinking. 54% thought their skin looked better. And 67% said, I've got more energy. And research does show that 6 months, being 6 months of drug and alcohol free, it really has a dramatic effect on damage done to our brains, our livers, our skin, and other internal organs. When you stop drinking for 6 months or more, the risk of the liver disease decreases and immune function improves. And your liver is actually a remarkable organ that can regenerate in your body. And that can happen if you're stopping early. Now, the question is, did this really help people stop drinking? So a 2021 survey done in America found the average American only lasted about 10 days into Dry January before they gave up. 1 in 10 gave up by January 3rd. Now, if you listen to my show on New Year's resolutions and you've ever made a New Year's resolution yourself, this should be wholly unsurprising. And the sad thing is that if you are struggling with addiction to alcohol or substances, it's really hard to get over that. 75 to 95% of people with addiction, they end up relapsing even after they complete alcohol treatment. Now, one of the things that I'm concerned about is that COVID actually prompted the biggest drinking spike in 50 years. So we saw a lot of people isolated, a lot of people lonely, and we saw an increase in alcohol consumption. But an interesting paradox to that is that Gen Z is actually embracing low drinking trends. They call it NOLO, which means no or low alcohol. Or they're embracing terms like mindful drinking or being sober curious. You might be curious about that term, but sober curious means I'm thinking about not drinking. Or other kids will say they're going 99% sober, and that means they only drink on the rare occasion, maybe have a glass of champagne at their parents' anniversary party or something like that. And this can be a good strategy for those who feel the pressure of failing, like they feel like, I can't just go cold turkey. And it is driving industry demand for non-alcoholic drink alternatives. This was interesting to me. I'm waiting for the new numbers to come out, but in 2022 alone, $11 billion for non-alcoholic drink alternatives. So these sober, curious drinkers, they value taste over the effect that alcohol has on you, and they want mocktails. Now, some of you may make a good mocktail. Some of you may be saying, what is that? It is a mocktail. So mocktails are very popular among young people. Now, I will say that my kids trolled me a little bit when I made a post about this on my Instagram because they said it was clickbait. And I said, I won't be participating. But that really, and okay, that's fair criticism. But the reason is because I actually choose not to drink at all and enjoy the health benefits of that. And I did post about this later in last year, and I talked about why I don't drink. And this really happens to me actually quite a bit. I'll be at a social event and offered a glass of wine or a cocktail or a beer, whether I'm at a professional conference or a brunch or whatever it may be. And I'll always smile. I try to smile and I'll say, no, thank you. And usually the conversation goes something like this. Are you sure? Yes, I'm good. Thank you. Is something wrong? Not at all. I just don't drink. Why not? Are you pregnant? Are you super religious? Are you diabetic? Are you on medications? Are you a designated driver? Wait, are you an alcoholic? Oh my gosh, did I just offer you a drink and you're an alcoholic? So now when I'm offered a drink, I just say, thank you for offering, but I just choose not to drink. Alcoholism runs in my family. And it's best for me to abstain. Thanks for understanding. But it's hard. I'm telling you, it's hard because people still look at me a little funny. And I think it's hard when I'm thinking about teens facing this, that alcohol is omnipresent in social functions. It is a staple of social functions. And if you decide to abstain or decline a drink, it immediately initiates an inquisition, a skepticism, or feelings of social isolation. I mean, we don't do this same thing if we offer someone an hors d'oeuvre and they say, no, thank you. In fact, we might, you know, applaud that choice and say, oh, that's good. I shouldn't have one either. But we don't have that same thing with drinking. And declining to drink often makes those who are offering it to you, they feel defensive because they have a perceived assumption that you think less of them for drinking. And that can get really awkward really fast. And when you're not walking around with a drink in your hand, the same conversation plays out in every new group that you approach. And I think teens can face this same pressure when they are in social situations. And it invites social pressure. People will tell you, live a little, or just have one, or you're not going you know where for having a drink. And it often leads to not being invited next time because, well, we know you don't drink. And I thought, if I'm a 40-something-ish woman struggling to navigate this, I really can't imagine the pressure that teens feel. But again, Gen Z is drinking 20% less than their millennial counterparts, and they are the ones that really started this mindful drinking movement. And so I think that we really need to talk to our kids and about how to respond if someone offers them a drink. Now, most kids, when they go someplace, they may not be intentionally going somewhere where there may be alcohol offered, and they may not be expecting that at all. And they get in a situation that's over their heads. And we need to make sure that we tell them that it is perfectly fine to say, no, I'm good with water, and give them an escape plan for that situation. Now, I've talked previously about having a code word. This is just a word that is a secret between you and your child. And what it is, it's an escape card. It's an escape word to say that I have gotten in a situation over my head and I need you to come and get me, no questions asked. Now, that can be an actual word, or it could even be an emoji that just is, hey, this is a secret code. Because sometimes if your child is in that situation, say they go to a friend's house or a party or a social gathering, and they recognize that this is not a place where I should be, they try to call you and they say, hey, can you come and pick me up? Yeah, why? What's wrong? Well, I think you should come pick me up. What's wrong? What's going on? Is there drinking going on there? Yeah, who's drinking? Whose mom's there? And then all of a sudden you're trying to have this conversation and it's very difficult for them to have. But just having that escape clause just gives them the opportunity to call you and to know that you are their safe place in that. And you can even make an arrangement that, hey, I'll come get you, no questions asked, until the next morning. Maybe let your emotions settle down, because sometimes you can be really angry or upset or have lots of questions, but sometimes just letting that settle down is really helpful. And this is something in dry January that we're seeing in the news. I just saw a news article talking about TJ Holmes and Amy Robach, who are TV hosts that were ousted from ABC over a very publicized affair. And they recently shared they spent $2,869 on alcohol in the month of December alone. And I thought it was really interesting because Amy was quoted as saying, I'm certainly somebody who needs to re-examine my relationship with alcohol. And she talked about not drinking to mask pain, but to enhance joy. And I can't help but thinking enhancing joy is a strategy to mask pain. So I know there are people out there who enjoy alcohol responsibly, and I'm not here to talk about whether or not you should drink. I'm just telling you about dry January and that no alcohol is ever safe for a developing teen brain. When we come back, I'll talk about that movie that I'm really concerned about. And you don't want to miss it. This is something really important that I'm seeing in a conversation among teens, and I'll tell you how to talk to yours about it. We'll be right back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at afr.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the show, friends. We are in Friday, and we are in Ask Dr. Nurse Mama Friday, where I'm answering all of the questions that I can that have been on your minds and your hearts this week as you're parenting. And doesn't it just seem like every week that goes by, like we just have something new that we have to navigate? But I want to give you some encouragement and let you know I do believe in the words of Scripture, and what Solomon said is that there is nothing new under the sun. We may encounter old threats in new ways, but for so many things, this all just boils down to very simple things in humanity, ways that it's just sin. That's just it. That's just the way that it is. And we have a challenge as parents to face those things head on. But let me tell you that your kids need you desperately to intentionally lead them in these difficult conversations. It's not going to come from your kids. They're not going to come and say, you know, I've been pondering about this issue and I'd like to seek some wise counsel. They're not going to do that when they're 13. You are going to have to pursue them and say, this is something you need to know. And you're going to have to say it over and over and over again. Just like it, most kids don't learn to ride their bike the first time. They don't learn to tie their shoes the first time. They don't become expert eaters the first time that they have a spoon. We have to teach these things over and over and over and over again. And I'm here to encourage you as you do just that. Now, one thing that has caught my attention is a question from parents everywhere saying, what is going on with this new movie? The movie is called Saltburn. And, you know, there are a lot of media things that come across my desk, that come across questions. And there are a lot of things that are really kind of gray, thinking, what do we need to discern out of this? I want to tell you that I'm really sad to say that this is not one of those issues. And as I started to think about it and to do some research and hear more kids talking about it, what I'm seeing too is a TikTok trend where, thank you TikTok for just some of the, you know, best things that come out of guiding young people. That was sarcastic, by the way, if you couldn't tell, but it's seeing a TikTok trend of before and after watching this movie. So they'll show their face before, I'm happy, I'm innocent, after, I'm shocked, I'm appalled. Well, what this does is this creates a morbid curiosity to know what happened that changed you as a person so much. How did one movie change you? And the thing that concerns me is that there's one word to me that describes the movie market for teens today. It's macabre. That's M-A-C-A-B-R-E, if you didn't catch that. And the definitions I got from the dictionary on that are dwelling on the gruesome, the horrifying, the ghastly. And it is a grim atmosphere preoccupied with violence or death. Now, the macabre draws teen audiences in droves. I want you to think about popular movies like Scream or It or all manner of other horror movies. These are salaciously, intentionally over the top. Their whole purpose is to drive that morbid curiosity. And when these things that seem so awful, that frankly are so awful, are whispered to their peers, then inquisitive minds are irresistibly drawn to know those secrets to the insider conversation. There are those who have seen it and those who haven't. There are those who are in the conversation and those who are out. Now, I want to be right up front and tell you we need to be raising kids who are very confident being out of the conversation, who seek to put themselves out of the conversation and know how to do that. We have to teach them to do that. We have to empower them to do that. And we have to let them know that we are proud of them for doing that and they are not alone. So for this particular movie, honestly, there are insufficient words to describe the gratuitous things that occur. And I'm not even going to do that here. All I can tell you is that to say that you would be absolutely shocked is an understatement. Now, I don't want to create that same kind of morbid curiosity, but want to say to you from one parent to another, from adult to adult, that there is nothing edifying knowing what's going on in this movie. And if you see that from a trusted source, that should be enough to shut that door of curiosity down. Now, one of the things to know is that the genre of this particular movie is advertised as a thriller slash comedy. It's sold as over the top to the point of absurd. Now, what this means is that when we read about it or hear about it, we kind of tend to get this pearl clutching, right? We go, oh my gosh, and we get indignant and we run to our kids and we say, have you heard about this horrible movie? And their reaction is just kind of condescending, if we're honest. And you just don't get it. No, mom and dad. No, it's not like that. No, it's not meant to be serious. So you don't understand. So we have to be really calm in our approach about this. And I would encourage all families to avoid this movie at all possible, in any way possible. Avoid any reviews, avoid any descriptions. Really, the truth is that no one is edified by the content. No one. So warn your teen if this is talked about in their social circles, which again, it can surprise you what kids may have talked about it. Don't ever have that "not my kid" mantra or "my kid would never," because all kids are kids. And tell them, if you hear any conversation occurring about this movie, run away, stand up, say, "This conversation is not for me. I'm leaving this conversation. You shouldn't have it either." Whatever it is that feels comfortable in their personality, but that is also very strong. It may be awkward, but I can tell you it's way less awkward than the conversation that would ensue. And so again, I think I talked earlier in the second segment about a code word. A code word is a great example for a way that you could have an escape plan here. Say your kid is at a friend's house and maybe their parents aren't there, or whatever situation it may be, and they decide to watch it. Great. Code word: escape. Come and get me. Help. I need help. And go and get them. That can be a really great escape plan. Now, here's the thing. If your teen does see the movie, if you find out they have seen the movie, if they tell you that they have seen the movie, I really encourage you to not approach with anger. Anger is alienating and it doesn't help. And I want you to know that the honest truth is that whatever yelling or shaming or grounding that you can give, it pales in comparison to, honestly, the trauma of what they've been exposed to. Because I can say that watching this movie would be traumatic for any teenager. It really would, whether they try to say it's funny or not. And so have some cultivated curiosity. Have a healthy measure of grace. So try something like this. Help me understand your thought process and the circumstances that led you to make the decision to watch this movie. Because most of the time, this is not a failure of morals. It doesn't mean that, oh, they threw all their morals out the window and they watched something that was against our standard. It meant the decision-making process was too fast for my developing brain, and I made a poor decision because I didn't have the time or guidance to think about it. And especially with streaming media, those decisions can be made so quickly. Just the tap of a thumb, the click of a button, then the media can be before their eyes. And so sometimes if they're presented with this situation and they're going to watch it, they can't think their way out of that situation fast enough. That's why I think having a code word is such a great thing to have with your kids, because that's something that they can enact quickly. They can enact that and say, "Okay, I don't know what to do, but I have an escape plan." Other questions that you can ask them are, "Tell me, what did you see that was new, unfamiliar, or uncomfortable to you? And how did it make you feel?" Now, you need to clearly outline the rules and the expectations for media consumption in your house and recognize that good kids make poor decisions, and we need to give grace, not shame. These images that are consumed in media are burned on our brains forever, and especially for developing brains of kids. Their brains are neuroplastic. It means they're more resilient, but they're also more susceptible to these things. And I've talked before about some of the science behind why people watch horror movies. It's because it gives them a chemical response of fear and a controlled substance, and then their brain automatically has calming responses which feel good. And so people can seek out that feeling. It's kind of not very different from riding a roller coaster when we're talking about biologically. But it's really important to replace those things. We can't, just say, "Oh, don't watch that. Don't think about that." We have to replace those images with things that are true, things that are honorable, things that are just, pure, lovely, commendable, and worthy of praise. So try to replace those with better images. Watch a family movie together, something that is, that is heartwarming, something that's going to make you feel good. And make sure that when you see your kids — this is what I would recommend to say to your kids who saw the movie. I would say something like this: "You deserve so much more than what was just presented to you. You do. Don't buy the lie that this is entertainment. You are worth infinitely more than that. You're more special. You're more valuable. You are more precious than what is being sold. You are worthy of real love. Do not settle for a cheap substitute. You are cherished and adored by me and by God. You are a treasure. Now, sometimes it can be hard to say things like that, parents, but that is the kind of thing that our kids need to hear. And if you're uncomfortable saying it in person out loud, then try writing them a letter. Our kids need to know rather than, how could you watch that? That's so disgusting. You should be ashamed of yourself. You know better than this. Those messages are just not helpful. And so we need to reframe it and tell them there's something better out there. You deserve that. You can strive for that. And so not too long ago, I had counseled and talked with a lot of young people who had made choices that they regret, and especially in relation to what they had done in their physical or romantic relationships. And that is related to a lot of what is portrayed in this movie and many others that is extremely normal. And so I wrote an open letter to young people who had regrets. And if there are people, this is actually on my Instagram, you can find it if you want to, I would encourage you to share something like this with kids, because they know a lot of times what they did was wrong, or that they deeply regret what they did. And sometimes the natural consequences of what they experience is sufficient, and piling shame on top of that is not helpful. And so this is what I wrote as an open letter. Dear one, I see you. I may not know your personal story, but I've heard enough stories to assure you that you are not alone. Although the circumstances of your story are unique, the resulting trauma you experience is very much the same. Regret is a familiar and heavy weight you carry in your chest. Shame has been an invisible cape that drags on the floor behind you. Fear is an ever-present companion as you wonder if someone will say something, know something, or see something about your past experiences. You wonder if people will judge you or exploit your pain. You feel vulnerable. You wonder about all the if-onlys. If only you had never met them. If only you hadn't gone to that party. If only you had said no. Hear me say this loud and clear. These choices may have been what you did, but those actions don't have to define who you are. Every person on this earth makes mistakes. We all have regrets, but there is grace. There is forgiveness. There is healing. There is freedom from shame and fear. And if you're carrying secret pain, it's time to talk to a trusted adult in your life. That may be your parents, another relative, a teacher, a counselor, a coach, a spiritual leader, or your healthcare provider. You will heal more quickly with healthy support at your side. You don't have to walk this road alone. It's not about what you've done, but about what's been done for you. This is not about where you've been, but where your brokenness brings you to. You are more than the choices that you've made. You are the more than the sum of your past mistakes. You are more than the problems you've created. You've been remade. You may recognize those as lyrics to a song, but God loves you more than you'll ever know. God's word says you are forgiven. You are a new creation. You are set free. You are redeemed. You are beloved. You are being transformed. You are the apple of my eye. You are my child. You are pleasing. You are never alone. You are a masterpiece. Let today be the day you decide you won't be defined by your past, but instead you'll find hope in your future. Let today be the day you leave shame and fear behind, but instead embrace grace and forgiveness. Let today be the day you intentionally start a path to recovery and a new future. You are precious. These are the words that your kids need to hear. Well, I'll see you next week. We'll have lots more to talk about and introduce that third healthy habit. I hope to see you there.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.